Good morning, everybody. Is everybody going on the zip line? No. I can't wait for that. Recovery spirituality. I kind of like that topic. For the longest time, I really thought not drinking was my solution to being an alcoholic. I thought that certainly that was important, and if I went about the practice of not drinking, I would start to put the years together, like some of the old timers at some of the groups that I was going to, and my life would fall into place because I was sober for a longer period of time. I really did believe that things would get better in my life the longer I stayed away from a drink. It seemed like that's what people were talking about. It seemed like when people were picking up their coins, they were talking about how much better it has gotten, and it's because they don't drink anymore. What I later started to realize is just because I had put down the drink didn't mean my life was falling into place. There were a lot of things that were still going wrong. I still had really bad relationship issues with, even if it was friends, but with family. My family still looked at me like I was a time bomb ready to go off. For a long time, my ex-wife didn't really feel comfortable sending my daughter for the visits every couple of times a year. It didn't seem like my employment was getting any better. I was a bad electrician in a bad electrical contracting firm, that wasn't real fulfilling to me. I want to go backwards in time a little bit to the mid-1970s. There was a period of time, I came out of the gate just a grievously crazed alcoholic. I wasn't as alcoholic as I later became, but I had the allergy of the body from the get-go, so whenever I drank, problems would happen. And I got in a lot of trouble in the early 70s. But by around 1976 or so, I'd had a DUI. I'd had some realization that I needed to get my life together a little bit. The high school parties were becoming fewer and further between. There weren't as many people to do crazy things with anymore. It seemed like people were getting on with their lives. They were going off to college. Some of them were taking full-time jobs. Some of them were getting married. And I saw my peers growing up around me. And I wasn't doing that. I was still looking for the high school party. So I had some realizations after a DUI. A DUI really was not something that I wanted back in 1974. I got my first one. And when I got my license back, I kind of made a deal with myself that I was going to calm down. And what I started to do is I started to go on the marijuana maintenance program. Does anyone know about that? I still had periods of time where I got way drunk. That was a regularity, but I was trying to control the damaging effects of my drinking with, just being stoned. And during that period of time, for whatever reason, I started to feel drawn toward spirituality. And this was still in the middle of my drinking. I started to be drawn toward it. There was some rock bands that showed signs of spiritual progress. Like I really liked the rock band Yes, and if you started to read their lyrics, they certainly were about spiritual concepts and about spiritual growth. And I was always a reader, so I started to buy a lot of books, and a lot of these books had to do with spirituality. They were bizarre spirituality, but like the Carlos Castaneda stuff, I got involved in that. The Suzuki stuff, the Zen stuff. I just started buying these books on spirituality. And looking back in hindsight, I was being drawn toward filling a hole that I had within me. And, you know, some of the recovery people that I've paid a lot of attention to believe that, you know, we have a God-shaped hole. And we try to fill it with alcohol, and we try to fill it with drugs, and we try to fill it with sex, and we try to fill it with food, and we try to fill it with money. Because there's something very, very seriously incomplete within us. We know that there's something more important and something better out there. And I wasn't the type of person to run off and find a teacher in the 1970s. I was going to do this myself. So I was reading these books, and these books would give me a little bit of comfort. When you read spiritual books, they can warm your soul a little bit. But they're not necessarily transformative, because without the practical application of spirituality, it's an empty exercise. You can become incredibly conversant in spiritual concepts you have little experience with, and that's what basically happened to me. On the outside, it looked like I was trying to become a spiritual person. I remember the woman that I was with at that time. I ended up marrying her, and she was convinced, because of my talk and the books I was reading, that things were going to get better. Because look at what Chris is involved with. Look at what he's reading. You know, he's reading The Course in Miracles. He's studying G.I. Gurdjieff. You know, and all these deep intellectual thinkers. But the fact of the matter was, I was alcoholic. And I was an untreated alcoholic, playing games with spirituality because it was bringing me a little bit of comfort. But I was so chronically alcoholic that the alcoholism overcame any of that spiritual stuff fairly quickly. So that three or four year period of time when I was on my quest, got eroded by active alcoholism, and I was no longer reading those books. I was reading science fiction, you know, and things that were, you know, taking me further away from myself. Being in myself was becoming more and more uncomfortable. But the fact of the matter is that I recognized, even early on, even before I'd progressed, that there was some type of a spiritual answer. I just didn't have the wherewithal to access it. Fast forward about 10 years. My life blows up. I end up in Alcoholics Anonymous. And at first, I was under the impression that I needed to just remain sober and things would get better. But I truly believe that the alcoholic is an extreme example of someone who has a vacancy within themselves that needs to be filled with something of the spirit. It needs to be. Now, I was also kind of a bizarrely untrained intellectual. You know, I read a lot of books. I studied a lot of science, and I believed a lot in the human potential too at that time. I believed that if you were going to grow, you were going to do it by works. You were going to do it under your own power. You were going to do it by achievements. So there was a lot of confusion in my life. I get sober, and I'm going to a lot of step meetings. Around our area at that time, there were step meetings, speaker meetings, and discussion meetings. The big book meetings were few and far between and rather bizarre. So I was going to about, in my meeting mix, I was going to about 4 step meetings a week. And, you know, looking back, I probably went through the 12 and 12. I probably went through that book a couple of hundred times in my first 5 years, just going to all these meetings, because in the meetings you would read the entire step. And in those steps is kind of a vision of spirituality, a vision of appropriate behavior, kind of a blueprint for, you know, moving forward in this sober life. And I was viewing all this stuff intellectually, but I wasn't capable of change. You learn so much, you know, in hindsight. You know what your problems are after they've been solved, oftentimes, in recovery. And now I understand what my problem was. I was trying to learn my way recover. And I did it through additional books. In the big book it says, you know, there are great books out there. Ask some priest ministers or rabbis. I didn't do that part. You know, I went off on my own and I started up again my quest for spiritual momentum by going to the bookstore, by finding catalogs, by, you know, a lot of times in those early days people were passing around books. Emmett Fox was passed around a lot. The Road Less Traveled was passed around a lot. And reading those books, again, gives one a sense of temporary comfort. Yet, the needed change usually doesn't come on its own. Looking back, I needed to remove the obstacles in my path that were separating me from the practical application of spirituality. In other words, I had to go back to Spirituality 101. I was reading all the advanced textbooks, you know, because we're like that. Don't give us the rudimentary stuff, but we're way past that. You know, give us the graduate level stuff. So I reintroduced myself to a whole crap load of spiritual books. There was a period of time in 2002 where I had to move out of a very large house. And in this house, I had a whole bedroom that was a library. And not only was every wall filled, floor to ceiling, with bookshelves filled with books, but I had about 90 boxes of books in the basement that wouldn't even fit on the shelves. You know, listen, obsessive compulsive behavior isn't just with drugs and alcohol. You know, it was like, wow, if a spiritual book is good, 4,000 must be better. So, I mean, I had this incredible library of stuff, and I even read some of them. You know, so I was back at this. But what I needed, and I needed it very, very desperately, was exposure to a teacher. I needed a teacher, because what teachers will do is they can recognize the prerequisites that you've missed. They can be your academic spiritual advisors, and they can point you back to lessons that you've learned that are sabotaging your spiritual growth or your intellectual growth at present. And I ended up with a couple of teachers. One of them was a man named Happy Grateful Ray. He unfortunately became so heavenly, he became no earthly good, and he got drunk. And I went on the 12-step call on that one about 5 years later. But he did expose me to some stuff. But where I really learned the basics, and without the basics, you're not going to get very far, was from the big book teachers, from the recovery teachers. My first real teacher, the person who cleared away enough of the stuff in front of me so that I could really start to grow spiritually, was Joe Hawk, originally with the Salvation Army Talks, and later, you know, I had the wonderful opportunity of working with him personally. He understood that the intellect is not necessarily the way to spiritual growth. It's more in the application of spiritual principles than it is in your deep understanding. And I had to go back to square one, and I had to go back to the steps. I had to go back into the steps like I'd never gone into them before. And I remember one of the first serious exercises he gave me was first step exercises. And I really thought I was beyond this, you know. Now, come on, I know I'm an alcoholic. Let's get to the good stuff. But he kept me in step one exercises for about 6 months, which is kind of bizarre. I mean, he had me doing these exercises, and then I had to meditate, and then I had to go back and redo them, and then I had to do more meditation. And there was a lot of Zen in Joe. And what I mean by that is a really good Zen master will never let you ever think that you've got it. As soon as you think you've got it, what you're doing is you're closing the door on really getting it. So I remember I would call him up and I'd say, Joe, man, that exercise, you know, I thought you were such a horse's ass giving me that exercise, but man, now that I've done it, let me tell you, oh man, it was unbelievable. Now I understand. And he'd say, no, you don't. You've got it completely wrong. And I'd be like, oh. Some of the lessons that I learned from this was, again, it was about these exercises. It was about this journey. It was about continuance, persistence and continuance with these practices. Make no mistake, if you're alcoholic, alcohol is not your problem. Alcoholism is your problem. And if you have alcoholism, applied spirituality is your solution. There is no other solution that I've ever seen. And I've been around a lot of professional treatment people. And I'm not saying AA, applied AA principles is the only way. I'm saying applied spirituality is the only way. And applied spirituality is much different than intellectual spirituality. I had to do these things. I had to do the fourth step and the fifth step. I had to do the amends. I had to go out and make the amends. I had to go back. And that probably, you know, different people have different parts of the step process that challenge them more than others. I think the amends part challenged me more than anything. And it was because of the sense of self that I was hanging on to. Like Marcia talked about before, I was so attached to what I thought you thought about me. Nothing would humiliate me more than to think that I looked small in your eyes. I would tell my story at a meeting of 30 people and 29 would shake my hand and say, great story, Chris, that was one of the best stories I've ever heard. And one person would go, you sounded a little bit pompous. And I would go home like, oh my God, I'm pompous. You know, that's an unhealthy attachment to an ego and a sense of self. Now, for me to be able to get past that, I had to do a whole lot of spiritual work. I did. I had to do the, you know, there's a saying in AA. We don't care what your opinion is. We care what your feet are doing. And that's really, really true, I believe, with those that are alcoholic. Your opinion, although it may be interesting at 4 days sober, is not as important as where your shoes are taking you, you know? Are you going to a meeting? Are you actually participating in this recovery process? Now the spiritual teacher, and I've had many, but the spiritual teacher that was the most impactful on my life, again, was Joe. Joe was a man of extreme in many, many ways. And when it came time for him to put into application spirituality, he went further than anyone I've ever known in AA. He spent a year studying with an Indian shaman, Don Coyas, in Denver, you know, doing the sweat lodges and, you know, all that stuff. Spent 5 years with him under his tutelage. Spent another 5 years with a Zen master in California. Spent another 5 years Thomas Keating, one of Thomas Merton's proteges, and then 5 years under the principal tutor of the Dalai Lama in Dharamsala, India. I mean, this guy took it to extremes, you know, and what he had in the very, very beginning was a marvelous structure of spiritual mechanics that he never let go of. He never got too far in the door. You know that great poem, I Stand by the Door? Joe never went too far in to be able to reach back out and help those who were not as far along on the path. And a lot of the application of these spiritual teachings, he was able to apply them to recovery. Because, listen, 12-step recovery philosophy is spirituality 101. The lessons that you learn in 12-step recovery philosophy are applicable in every spiritual discipline, in Christianity, in Judaism. If you're studying Hinduism or Tibetan Buddhism or Zen Buddhism, you're going to say, geez, that's step six or something like that. The wonderful miracle I see of Bill Wilson at 3.5 years sober, having his head far enough out of his ass to put together these basic spiritual principles in the 12 steps still is remarkable to me. I don't know how you would be... If I would have written a book at 3.5 years sober, it would have been a pile of crap, you know? So he was at the right place at the right time with the right people, and he took his job very, very seriously, and there was a lot of input, you know, the first 100 or so, you know, there was a lot of input and a lot of suggestions, and it was kind of an open system until, you know, the final revisions. And I see that as our prerequisite. What a prerequisite is before you move on, you need to take this class. And I think as alcoholics, there is room to broaden and deepen our spiritual growth in 100 forms of practice and devotion. There really is. But if we skip the prerequisites of surrender, of identifying that of our own unaided will, you know, our lives are not going to be successful, you know, on our self-will. If we skip that, if we skip the honesty that comes from doing a fourth and a fifth step and that confessional, aspect of four and five about how much sand our feet really are, you know, how much clay we're really standing on. If we skip, 6 and 7, where we recognize that our character defects are much larger than us and we need a power greater than us to move past these character defects. If we skip making things right for the harms that we've caused, if we skip learning prayer and meditation as a discipline, if we skip the attitude of compassion and service that the 12-step really points us toward, if we skip those lessons, as an alcoholic, our spiritual life is going to be empty. It's going to have periods of time where on the outside we can look very, very spiritual indeed. But on the inside we're going to be hollow and we're going to be, an empty gong as the Apostle Paul says, you know, the clanging of a cymbal, you know, it really means nothing. So, you know, spiritual growth has become probably the most important part of my life. Now, some other lessons that I learned, I learned this lesson especially from Mark Houston, is he would approach a spiritual book as a textbook. I can't say that I'm there yet. I like to read these books, and I like to apply certain pieces of them. But what he would do is work with one book and try to gather as much of the application of that book as possible and put it into practice. And I know some of the books that he used. And you could see, I think in no other person I ever met or knew, you could see the power in Mark Houston. This whole thing, this whole recovery process, I believe is about freedom, and I believe it's about power. It's about exposing ourselves to the actual power of God and allowing ourselves to be accessible to the power of God moving in and through us and doing for us what we cannot do for ourselves. And you can see this power. You can see this power in certain people who have done the application of these principles in their lives. They're not necessarily the smartest people. They're not necessarily the coolest people, but they're the people who have done the most application of these principles. And you can cut the power coming out of them with a knife. And I think we've all met and been exposed to people like that. They can do things that are absolutely remarkable, and they usually take no personal credit for it because they know where the power comes from. They know it is not their power. Every once in a while, I'm reading this great book now called After the Ecstasy, the Laundry. And what this book talks about is it talks about as an innate need in the human condition, we desire enlightenment. It's an instinctual drive that I believe God instilled in us so that we instinctively try to head in the right direction. Now, there's a lot of things that screw this up. Money, power, sex. There's a lot of things that screw up this drive in us. But I believe it's been implanted in us to grow spiritually. That's why we feel that vacancy sometimes with that God-shaped hole. There are a lot of things that mess this up, and there are a lot of people who start the spiritual path and go wrong. In this book, it talks about some of the spiritual masters who've really screwed up big time. It usually involves sex and power and money. And they abuse the God-given power. The power does not come from the human condition. It comes from God. And then once they get this power, they become drunk with it. And they can, once you have this spiritual power, it's a lot easier to seduce. It's a lot easier to gather money. And it's a lot easier to gain a crew of people that will do for you. And there's a lot of abuse, and there's a lot of stories about people who have gone wrong, and the disasters that follow. And I believe those are great lessons because they remind one once again that this is not our power. On a daily basis, we need to do the things that we need to do to keep the ego in check. There's an age-old battle. You can go back you can go back thousands of years. The earliest literature that we find, you know, Homer's Odyssey. I mean, stuff that was written thousands and thousands of years ago. A lot of times it's stories about a hero and how he had to overcome these temptations and how he had to try to do the next right thing, even though it was not easy. And it talks about this duality, conflict that we have in our mind between the spirit and the ego, or the good and the evil, or the devil and the God. I mean, you will read about this over the course of written literature. It's not something that's new. What we need to know as alcoholics is we can't lose this battle. Because if we lose it, the thing that keeps us safe and protected from alcoholic death is a solid spiritual condition. And the normal man out there walking up and down the road who maybe goes to church on Sunday, or maybe he's practicing in an ashram, or, you know, maybe he has his own different types of spiritual worship, they can survive screwing it up. As alcoholics, we pay the ultimate price for failure to adhere to these spiritual principles. The spiritual principles that Bill makes very, very clear in Spirituality 101, which is the book Alcoholics Anonymous. So that's an additional warning to us as alcoholics. When the ego is left unchecked in an alcoholic, the ego goes to the bar. The ego goes to the cop man. And there's usually not a great outcome. Alcoholism and drug addiction, if you look at it purely scientific from outside of the recovery fellowships, it's a very, very bleak landscape. Statistically, many, many more than most of us die of this. There's a half-life to crack addicts that's extraordinarily short. There's a longer half-life to alcoholics, but it's not very long. Insurance companies understand that if we've had professional treatment for these things, we're not a great risk for life insurance. Looking at it objectively from outside, you can see that more than most of us die. And what I see is the minority that escape this fate are ones that embrace a spiritual path. They find the right way. And again, you don't have to be smart to find the right way. You just have to be persistent. And having a good guide helps. In Alcoholics Anonymous, in the 12-step world, I make it a suggestion to people whenever I'm doing treatment commitments to be very, very discerning when you find a sponsor. And do a little bit of qualification, even though it may feel real uncomfortable to be interviewing a prospective sponsor. There are many, many people out there who have not grown past tertiary spirituality in Alcoholics Anonymous. There are a lot of people that you could ask to be your sponsor who do not have real experience with the 12 steps. I know I did it myself. My first sponsor, who God love him, kept me sober enough to find recovery and find a correct path towards spirituality early on. He shouldn't have even been in AA. Okay? He was a speed freak who got arrested, went to AA to keep from going to jail, and found a social clique. It worked for him. You know, he liked crazy people. So he became a meeting maker, and he even had a very serious service ethic. He liked to do things for people because it made him feel good. But he wasn't an alcoholic. I was a really in trouble alcoholic. And I went to him, and he gave me at least what he could. He wasn't trying to hurt me, and he didn't even know he wasn't giving me the right stuff. You know, how do you know what you don't know? But what he did do was he gave me enough for sobriety to at least last long enough for me to find teachers who could teach me about spirituality and about alcoholism. So finding the right guide, finding the right teacher is important. You know, every single person that spoke here today, they've got serious ass sponsors and teachers. And it's not necessarily the people in their home group, although sometimes it is. Sometimes it's people many, many states away because they take They take placing themselves under the care and direction of a spiritual guide very, very seriously. And they want the best possible guidance that they can get. And that is very, very important to me also, because this is not a game. If somewhere along the line I become drunk with the power that's not mine anyway, I need to be accountable to somebody. Somebody needs to have the spiritual consent to kick me in the ass and say, Chris, your ego is running wild. You need to slow down. We need to talk. I need somebody that will do that. And that's a life and death job for somebody, to continue to grow spiritually, you have to find people who are ahead of you on the path. A lot of times that's the right way to go. You need to find people who are a little bit further down the road and who can continue to keep giving you the guidance that's going to continue to help you to grow in understanding and effectiveness, to continue to participate in the maintenance of your spiritual condition. And that's a very, very important part of our lives. Now, if spirituality, if all it was a treatment for my alcoholism, I would do it anyway. But the great news about spirituality is it offers you literally hundreds of remarkable, incredible promises in your life. Your life starts to grow so large that it's almost unbelievable. When I think what has been accomplished with me in the last 5 years, me, the guy who could screw up a guitar lesson. I mean, now, listen, this is me prior to applying some of the spiritual principles. I wanted to be a Boy Scout. Joined the Boy Scouts. Went on one camping trip. Wanted to learn the guitar. Went and took one guitar lesson and stole the guitar. Decided to join the wrestling team. Did one practice. Quit. Decided to go to college. Spent 3.5 years getting 6 credits. This is me. So I am telling you, the things that have happened in my life come as a direct result of the power that flows in and through me. It's not my power. It's not necessarily reflective of the work that I'm doing. The work that I'm doing empties the vessel so that it can be filled with the power. And I said this, it's dangerous to think that it's your power. But some of the things that have been accomplished in my life in the last 5 years are bizarrely, incredible. I got a chance to do an XM and a Sirius satellite radio show. Just by accident. I mean, I got interviewed on this radio show, and the woman that owned that particular station said, "Hey, would you like to be the host from now on? I really liked what you said." So I said, "Sure." I mean, I didn't know anything about being a host of a radio show, especially a satellite show that went everywhere and had 70 affiliates from Calcutta through London to San Francisco. And because I was awake to opportunity, and because there was a lack of self-centered fear in my life, because of that sense of guidance, that intuitive sense of guidance that I was awake to, I just said yes. I didn't say to myself, "I'm going to suck at this and I can't, I'm afraid." I just said yes, because it was an awesome opportunity. It was a show where you interviewed different people from 12-step fellowships, and I was just a host. I wasn't a member of any fellowship or anything. I anonymously interviewed people from different 12-step fellowships. I will say this, the strangest and scariest 12-step fellowship, the people that I interviewed was Sex and Love Addicts Anonymous, okay? My buddy Dave and I are saying, "Hey, there's two chicks coming from Sex and Love Addicts Anonymous. That should be interesting." By the end of the show, we were changing our name and telling them we lived in a different state. We were scared. A relapse for them was multiple restraining orders. You know what I mean? They were stalking some bitches. But anyway, I had a great time doing that. You know, I actually hosted a TV show, a music TV show for a short period of time. It was a cable show. I went from that to being asked by a big recovery organization, a multi-million dollar recovery foundation to put together a web platform and a web broadcasting and interview addiction treatment professionals for the sole purpose of highlighting the best practices out there in addiction treatment. And for 2.5 years I did that, and I flew all over the planet interviewing some really, really interesting people. You know, I'm a bad electrician. Where does that come from? You know, somewhere along the way, because I started to become halfway dependable in my life, I went from being a bad electrician to getting into facility services. And about a year and a half ago, I was offered the job to take over an account for a pharmaceutical company running their facility department. Now, being a facility director is a high-level job at these places, because you're in charge of all the processes that keep them being able to manufacture these life-saving drugs. I mean, if I screw up, the assembly lines stop. You know, it's a big responsibility. And in the last year, I've been able to increase the scope of that job 4 times. I went from a $2 million baseline to a $10 million baseline in a year. I became, out of 19 accounts, I became the number one facility manager in the country. I was number one in customer satisfaction and number two in financial performance. And I'm an idiot. You know what I mean? Like, I can't go to motor vehicle to get my license back without being drunk. You know, I did that one time. I'm getting my license back for a third DWI, and I went there just as drunk as could be. That was a really bad move. You know, I was never dependable at anything. You have to be dependable to be able to do jobs like this. I get invited to places like this. I have a group of friends who have all come to me. Almost all of them have come to me through the application of recovery principles in one way or another, whether they're my sponsees or whether they're just fellowship brothers, fellowship sisters. And my biggest problem today is the amount of time I have in the day, because I have so much opportunity and so many people that I want to connect with at deeper levels that I don't have time to do. You know, that's my biggest problem today, that I don't have enough time to do the great things that are in front of me. You know, these friendships are, these are people that would take a bullet for me. I always wanted friendships like that. But Green Man and Weezer just hung around until the coke was gone, you know. I always wanted those types of friendships. I think we're a tribal people, instinctually. And we need to be tribal. We need to have our crew. And today I have that. And I can call on people. Not that I need people that often, because if you successfully or even somewhat successfully apply spiritual principles in your life, you know, you tend to not get in too many jackpots. So things tend to run pretty smooth in your life. But I've got a crew of people that I can really, really count on. Some of the great promises in the book that I see overlooked all the time, certainly the 10-step promises are great promises. They're promises that those are the freedom promises. We're free. We do not need to be meeting dependent if we've recovered. We will be going back to meetings because that's the place where there are people to help. We're not going to be going back to meetings to fill up like it's a spiritual gas pump. You know, Like, I had a real hard day at work today. I'm going to double up on my meetings tonight. If you're doing that, you are going in the opposite direction that you should be going in. You'll be going to meetings for the right reasons instead of the selfish reasons. It will become an innate ethic to carry the message to other people. It will become instinctual, and that you will have an inner need to carry the message to other people. And that will come as a byproduct of recovery. You shouldn't need to be encouraged to go to beginners meetings or sponsor people. That will become automatic. And that is a great benefit. You look at any of the truly, truly happy people, and they have some type of a compassionate, charitable nature. They're doing something for somebody. A great example is, this is one of my sponsees who certainly surpassed the teacher. You know, some students surpassed the teacher. This guy was one of them. He was actually running the Bazooka Bubblegum Company, the Topps Company. And you remember Pokemon cards? That was him. Push Pops, that was him. Baseball cards, Topps cards, Bazooka Bubblegum, that was him. He was running that company. And when he started working with me, for whatever reason, he just became absolutely 100% willing to do everything that was asked of him. That's rare, unfortunately. But this guy just said, tell me what to do. And he took it like it was a college, you know, assignment. And he wanted to get an A. And he just went out and did it. And he went from making $500,000 a year to helping his company downsize and downsize him out. And right now he's running a soup kitchen because he volunteered at it for 5 years. They loved him so much, they said, would you run our soup kitchen for $20,000 a year or whatever? And he said, I would be honored. That on the outside looks like a downward trajectory in your employment line. It is anything but in this guy's life. He went from being very successful and inwardly empty to being more full than probably anyone I know with his spiritual practices. He's a go-to guy. If there are newcomers, there's nobody better than this guy, because he has the compassion to sit with these knuckleheads hour after hour after hour and just listen and just keep handing them exercises and encouraging them to do step work. And now he has a gigantic crew in North Jersey who are running around sponsoring people. You know, to see this fellowship that we crave grow up about us is amazing. It's amazing. And the way to create a fellowship is to carry the message to alcoholics in the way the book Alcoholics Anonymous asks us to. Now you have a crew. You know, Peter, you know what having a crew is like. You can call these guys any time and say, hey, I need you in Florida, and they would be there. You know, having this fellowship that you crave grow up about you is absolutely amazing. The best years of our lives are ahead of us. In the 80s when I was drinking, I was reflecting on how fun it was at the high school parties. You know, you'd get drunk out of your mind, and the music would be on, and there'd be a fight and a car crash, and you'd be inappropriate with the women, and they'd be okay with it, you know, and everything was just wonderful, at least that's what I thought. And as the years went by, I reflected, I lived in the past, I reflected back on these great years that I had, and wondered where it had all gone, and where it had gone wrong. One great promise is the best years of our life are ahead of us. Some of the things that happen through the application of spiritual principles is, Peter talked about this also, being trapped in the past and having anxiety of the future. They talked about living in the now, living in the now, be here now, living in the now. I didn't know what they were talking about in early sobriety because I hadn't done any of the things that you need to do to be able to clean yourself up enough so that you can be present to this holy instant. There is only the now. The past is but a memory and the future is uncertain. There's really only this holy instant. And to be able to embrace it and be comfortable with it is one of the true gifts of a spiritual life. You know, so many people die from anxiety, the things that are brought on by anxiety disorders, the hypertension and you know, the cardiovascular problems and cancer and all this other stuff is really brought on by an inability to live in the now. So much of our time is wasted regretting the past, thinking about what we should have done and the mistakes we made, and if only we could go back in time and do it differently. That's a complete waste of the holy now. And to be able to embrace that, to be able to sit in the silence. We cannot sit in the silence when we're dragging knapsacks full of crap from our past or we're worried about what's going to happen in the future. We can't sit in that silence. And I found personally that the true healing of my spirit comes in that deep silence and that deep connection to my Maker, to the God of my understanding. That's where the true healing is. This has been one of my favorite workshops that I've ever gone on. Every single person here, thank you so much for coming. This was a sojourn, you know. This was more than just going down the street to the meeting. But I think we've all experienced something here this weekend that we're going to be able to take with us. And if you've learned anything here, if anything has really stuck with you, if anything has disturbed you, sit with that and turn it into something that can be applicable to your spiritual growth. Take some of these lessons that you've learned, if you've learned anything, and apply them as the drowning would seize a life preserver. And if that's the case, this has been, with anyone, this has been an incredibly worthwhile venture for me. Thank you for being here.